Hello, I'm Paul Scott, and today I'm talking to Andy Hogarth, the CEO of Staffline. The ticker is STAF. Share price currently is £8.30, which gives a market cap of about £230 million. So welcome, Andy, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, quick disclaimers. I'm not charging a fee for this interview. I do currently hold a long position in the share, and I'm not giving recommendations or financial advice. So, okay, we usually start by me asking you to give a description of the business for any listeners who are not familiar with Staffline.
Right, okay, will do. Obviously, butt in if you want me to expand on anything.
Okay, will do.
The core business started in 1986, so it's 30 years old this year, and that business is all about the supply of labour forces into UK manufacturing industry, so food processing, food production, general manufacturing, distribution, logistics, warehousing, driving, that sort of thing. What we specialise in is blue collar, semi-skilled or unskilled work. Over the years we've developed not a unique model, but a probably slightly different model to most of our competitors, where we concentrate on something we call on-site. So instead of having a branch network, like most recruitment companies have, we have a network probably of about 20, very small. The vast majority of our business is done through on-site, where we have an office in the customer's premises, which means that the operating expenses are much lower because we don't have the rent and the rate costs of operating an office. Much lower staffing because in terms of health and safety and things, we don't need to have more than one person because there's plenty of other people from the client around. It's been a very successful model. It not only is it cheaper for us to run, but it gives the customer a significantly better service. Historically, workers were sourced by an agency in a town where they had their office and then would be either bused or somehow got to the client's premises somewhere on the outskirts of town. Now, we recruit in the locale of where the client is, which means that we can show people the job they'd be doing before they start, and if they don't like it, they don't start. And if the client wishes to recruit permanently, it's obviously much easier for them to do so if someone lives in the next street rather than somebody living on the other side of town. Mm-hmm. The service we offer is obviously recruitment, but also we do a site induction. So before somebody starts work, they'll have looked around, seen what the work is, know all about the health and safety aspects, fire procedures, that sort of thing. We may well do quite a bit of training on someone before they start work as well. So the people we provide are much more efficient from minute one than historically they would have been when they were just delivered to the factory gate. And then the client had to, whilst paying them, also look to train them and explain everything to them. The model has grown, as I said, significantly over the years. We joined the AIM market in December 2004, and our sales at the time were about 40 million, and our profitability was about a million. Obviously, it's a bit early to say what we'll do this year, but we're something sort of north of 800 million will be our sales this year. So huge growth over that period of time. The big thing we concentrate on is food. 75% of our business is in the food production and processing or transportation part of the UK, which means that it's fairly recession-proof. So in the last recession in 2008-09, our revenues were flat. We lost 22% of our profitability in 2008. And then started to grow again in 2009 and exploded in 2010. And that, whilst not brilliant, losing profitability is a lot better than most of our competitors did. Mm-hmm. So that's that part of the business. 5 years ago, we decided to to look at branching out into something else, and ended up buying a business called EOS, which ran the government's work program in Birmingham and the Black Country. The work program is the DWP's contract, which helps any long-term, either unemployed or ESA, Employment Support Allowance, customers, helping them off of benefits and back into work. Programs such as this have existed for probably 30 plus years in the UK, starting at the time when many steelworks and coal mines were shutting down, the idea being to retrain people back into different types of employment. When the coalition government came in, there was a significant change, and rather than trying to help people in a sort of social workery way, it became much more, actually, we'll solve people's problems if we get them a job. And so it was less about the issues that someone had and more about, actually, get a job. Mm-hmm. That was driven by austerity and the need for the government to save money, but actually it's been hugely successful. Unemployment was running at about 2.5 million when the programme started, and it's now just over 1.6 million. So huge reduction in unemployment and increase in employment as well through that time. So we had that one contract. We learnt a lot over the first couple of years, and then ended up buying a business called Avanta in 2014, and then another one called A4E in 2015, which were effectively doing the same thing but on a much bigger scale. So with those two acquisitions, we're now the largest provider to the DWP with 9 contracts. Now the biggest provider, and since then we've branched out in that part of our business into lots of other things as well. So we run a CRC contract, which is Community Rehabilitation Contract, the privatisation of probation services in England and Wales. We do a lot of training in prisons, 8 prisons in the east of England, where we deliver training to prisoners, helping to skill them, not necessarily to get work when they leave, but to give them more life skills. Some people use that to go into employment, but there's a lot more to someone leaving prison and going into work than simply giving them some skills. There's also a number of other things. We have the carers hub. So across the UK, under the Care Act in 2014, government made it mandatory for local authorities to provide support and assistance for people caring for mainly relatives or close family in their home. We have people as young as the age of 5 who are becoming almost full-time carers for their parents. And so we have a contract, it's the first of its kind for us, in Staffordshire and Stoke, where we provide support services for people providing that sort of care. We have independent living services, we have 3,000 people who are in receipt of payments from the local authorities for their own personal care and independent payments. We help manage that cash for them. We employ their carers for them, so run a sort of a payroll service. There's quite a lot of different strands to the business. We have 2,000 apprentices working at employers all over the UK. So whilst for most employers, the apprenticeship levy, which comes in 0.5% of payroll costs if your payroll is more than £3 million a year, that most employers see that as an additional cost come next April. We see that as a big opportunity. There'll be £3 billion a year raised from employers from that charge. Hmm. And some employers are just treating it as a tax and are writing it off. Others want to get value from it by upskilling their workforce. And although it's called an apprenticeship levy, it's not an apprenticeship in the traditional sense of a 16-year-old leaving school and going doing a plumbing course or whatever. It's anything up to level 7 MDQ, which is master's degree level. So a company could spend significant sums training their senior management team in all sorts of areas, should they wish to do so. So that next year is an area of growth. It won't be a lot so much next year as it comes in April, but the following years, as momentum increases, that will be huge. We also have adult skills budget, which is mainly used for pre-employment training. So we're training people before they go into employment, either jobs with our own clients, Staffline clients, or people coming from the DWP who have recently been made unemployed, where we will skill them and get them into work more quickly than they otherwise would. A good example of that in Birmingham, Jaguar Land Rover is still doing exceedingly well in growing their business. So they have a constant demand for forklift truck drivers. So we're training hundreds and hundreds of people with that skill. And it's a relatively quick course. It's obviously quite dangerous if you're not very good. So to pass is quite stringent. But once you've passed, then you've effectively got the ability to work for the rest of your life. So we add real value to people's lives by doing that. The tagline of the business is people, skills and jobs. So basically we will go into any area where we're working with people and giving them skills to help them to get into employment and then upskilling them and in generally helping them leave a more useful, more productive life. I hope that was all right. I feel as though I've talked and you haven't let you get in at all.
No, don't worry. No, it's all interesting stuff. There are a couple of areas, actually, I hadn't picked up on, and it was interesting to hear about the growth opportunities coming through for next year and the year after, because, I mean, one of the things that I'm a little perplexed about, and I think some of my readers are as well, is that the share price has halved, basically, from the peak about a year ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, Staffline was rated as at a premium to other sort of recruitment staffing type companies, and it's dropped right down now to a forecast PE ratio of only 7.5. So the market seems to be sceptical about. I mean, I think it's a sector thing as well, but I mean, there seem to be two key issues that the market's worried about. one is Brexit, which we can come on to in a minute, but in terms of the Welfare to Work programme. I mean, I saw from your interims that was 59% of your total group operating profits, so it's actually now become the bigger part of the business. But I believe the contracts are about to expire or have expired. Could you update us on that?
Yes. So the business is two halves, staffing and employability, which includes everything that I talked about, and that is 59%. So it's not that the work program is 59%, but all the other things as well. So those contracts were originally let for 5 years, and then with a 2-year runoff, they were extended by a year. So the referrals under the contract start next March, so March 17, and then the contracts run for a further 2 years, where we're working with all of the people that have been referred to us up until that cut-off point. The new contracts, in fact, about 2 o'clock this morning, we put our bid in to get onto the framework. So the new contracts, in order to be awarded a contract, the first hurdle is to be on the framework for each area in the UK. If you don't get onto the framework list, then you can't bid for anything. The government is quoting a number of 1.7 billion spend in the space over the next few years. Whereas the work programme is one very, very large contract covering 9 different payment groups, yeah, so 9 different types of people needing help, the new programme, the first one is going to be called the Work Health Programme, and that concentrates only on people with health issues, so ESA claimants. And then there'll be a series of other contracts being let behind that to help with all the other groups as well. There'll be a lot more local commissioning So whereas up until now the work programme was totally controlled by DWP, devolution means that Scotland is doing its own thing completely, so we're bidding for Scotland. England and Wales, apart from London and Manchester, has been divided into, I think, five separate areas. So you can, you know, assuming you get on the framework, you can bid for all of the contracts that come up in those five individual areas. London will be, well, we're not entirely sure what's happening with London yet. There's some sort of uncertainty on how that will move forward, and the same with Manchester as well. So there certainly is a degree of uncertainty around the space. It's, you know, in our staffing business, so long as we continue to do a good job, then we can be pretty assured that we'll continue to grow. Yeah, you know, we have a great sales machine, we have a phenomenal delivery machine. So as we've got bigger, our reputation has grown, and therefore we're becoming the kind of the equivalent of IBM a few years ago. You know, nobody ever got sacked for buying IBM. And in staffing, that's very much the case. So long as we continue to deliver a good service, that business will be fine. Whereas in government contracting, it's a bit more lumpy. You sort of lurch from one set of contracts to the next. And there is, of course, the risk that we don't achieve anything. You know, we don't get onto any frameworks. Now, I wouldn't be running this business if I thought that was likely, but things can happen. I suppose, you know, I take great confidence from the fact that there are 40 different contracts currently, so 40 different work programme contracts across the country, with either two or three providers in each area. There's more areas at the moment. Our business, when we bought Avanta and A3 in particular, the performance of that business was atrocious, to be fair. Every one of their contracts was in the bottom half of the performance, and a number were in the bottom quarter. Now, you know, with the official stats coming out of the DWP, all bar one of our contracts are in the top half, and we hold 7 out of 9 in the top 10, or sorry, the top 9 places. So we've dramatically changed the performance of those contracts. So we're good at what we do, and it's that relentlessness that is within the staffing business that we've moved into a sector that was pretty sleepy before, and, you know, we've taken an awful lot of costs out of the business. We've made it very much more efficient, because in the old days, providers were used to making a 25% return on sale, and that, as, you know, when you're spending public money doing something that, you know, is not rocket science, it's not that complicated. 25% return on sales just is not acceptable, I don't think. So, you know, our plan is to run a business that is incredibly efficient, will allow us to price so that we can make a 10% return on sales, but have, you know, significant cost leadership in the space.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds like there could be a bit of turbulence on the welfare to work side of things, but that you're pretty well positioned as a successful operator in that space. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. You know, the turbulence is that if, you know, I know we didn't, but if we didn't push the button to send the submission in at 2 o'clock this morning, like that guy who's trying to become UKIP leader.
And he forgot he was a day late with his application.
No, we haven't done that. Yeah. Absolutely guaranteed, because we've got receipts that that everything was received before the deadline, so that's okay.
Yes.
So I guess I'm sounding slightly cautious. As a business, we're not cocky. So I don't want to sound cocky at all, but, you know, I'm confident that that what we're doing and what we've done over the past couple of years has put us in an extraordinarily good position going forward.
Well, that's encouraging. So, I mean, I think this has moved on a bit from when I last spoke to you in the summer, when I think at that point it wasn't really sure what government policy was going to be, but from what you've just said, it sounds like government is continuing essentially with the more or less the same strategy with these welfare to work programs. Is that fair to say?
The fact that there will be programs, absolutely. The way that they're let and tendered is a different strategy, particularly with the more local input from the LEPs and local authorities, where historically they've not had any input at all. But the principle of there will be programs absolutely has continued. And there was, I'm not sure why, but there was a concern from certainly larger investors that government might just stop the program altogether. I don't understand why. You know, although unemployment has dropped significantly, there is still 1.6 million people on the unemployment benefit and a further 2.5 million people on ESA, so employment support allowances, which are people that have been told by their doctors they're unable to work. And these people aren't unable to work. It's suited government over many, many decades to classify someone as unable to work, because then they don't count as unemployed. They're just they're out of the job market, which massages the numbers. Now the cost of this, there's a cap of 22,000, I think, now for people on these benefits. That 2.5 million people on anything up to 22,000 per annum. I can't do that in my head, but it's a terribly big number. So government is very keen on reducing that. And there have been a number of pressure groups that are saying this is terribly unfair, and if somebody's ill, then they should be left to be at home and be ill. Mm. And we actually fundamentally disagree with that. There are some people who are actually terminally ill or have such a debilitating disease that they are unable to work. But the vast majority of people actually can work. They maybe can't do the job they used to do, so they've lost their physical fitness. I was in the carers' hub yesterday up in Stoke, and they were talking about an example of a guy who'd been coming in there as a volunteer. He'd been working in the potteries, had had an accident, and had lost his sort of physical ability. By doing work experience there, they'd ended up training him to working in an office on computers, VDU entry. And he's just got a permanent job with a local employer in an office. Now, he probably would have thought, I can never do that. But by giving the people the training and the confidence to do so, you actually open up a new avenue for their lives that transforms them. So somebody who's dependent on state benefits, all of a sudden, it becomes independent again. I don't think there's not many things that are better than doing that. So we get huge satisfaction out of what we do. Mm. And fortunately, it is also commercially successful. So for me, it's an absolutely perfect balance of worthwhile and what we do, but profitable as well.
Shall we turn to Brexit next? I mean, this seems to be the sort of burning issue, because I know, and several readers have submitted questions about this as well. I think the background to this is that I believe about 75% of your workers in the staffing division are Eastern European.
Yes.
So could you sort of expand on this subject and how you see things moving forwards?
Yeah, and that has grown significantly. It was, the last time we looked, which is probably 18 months ago, it was, I think, 56%, just over half. And we've grown hugely in the last couple of years, and it's gone to 75%. So, yes, if there's a hard Brexit and everybody is told to go home overnight, then we would definitely have a problem, an issue.
Mm.
I take heart from the fact that actually as a business, every year, every 18 months, there's something happens that everybody says, that's the end of the business model, it will never work again. Agency workers regulations came in during the Labour government, and everybody felt that was the end. But the fundamental thing that we have to remember is that the service we offer our customers, both the people and the paying customer, you know, the supermarket chain or the food manufacturer, is that what we offer is flexibility. 52% of what's sold in supermarkets nowadays is on special offer, which means that if you're, as a manufacturer, your product is on offer, suddenly demand goes through the roof, and once it's off offer, then it falls through the floor. So you cannot afford to carry a workforce at the highest level. You have to staff to the lowest level of demand. So my approach to Brexit is that there's a number of sort of different strands, so I'll try and get them in the right order. The first thing is the jobs that we're doing. There's 3.5 million Eastern European people working in the UK now, and the jobs that they're doing exist. They exist now, they'll exist post-Brexit, particularly the jobs we're doing, because, as I said, it's food production, so it can't be moved offshore, or very little of it can. You know, you can't bake a loaf of bread in Poland and then import it, because the supply chain has to be so short. So the jobs absolutely will exist. As a part of the background to this, we have the introduction of national living wage. So national minimum wage last April in this year was, until then, £6.70. The living wage was introduced and took that to £7.20. And by 2020, that's going to be £9. So the cost of labour is becoming a much greater percentage of the cost of production than to employers than it has been. So again, they need more flexibility. They need the ability to pay people for the work they're actually doing rather than paying them fixed shifts. So if the production line comes to an end, 20 minutes, half an hour before the end of the shift, they need the ability to be able to say, well, thanks very much, we've finished for the day, and let people go home rather than continue to sit around. So this is some of the backdrop to what's happening. In terms of Brexit, all of the indications so far are that the people that are already in the UK will be allowed to stay in the UK going forwards. And yeah, we have the sort of the Brexiteers saying that they want a hard Brexit and therefore nobody else is allowed in, but nobody seems to be saying, and we want everybody to leave.
Yeah.
So the day after Brexit, excuse me, can I just have a cough? Hold on a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right, there we go. The day after Brexit, nothing changes because everybody is, you know, the 3.5 million people are still in the UK.
Yeah.
But gradually, the supply of new people will start to fall. We are in an ideal position to take advantage of that because of our employability business, where we're helping long-term unemployed people get back into work. We have lots of people looking for work and jobs that up until now, employers have been very keen on employing Eastern Europeans to do the work because they are more flexible than UK workers. So it's up to us to educate employers that actually used to have the benefit of Eastern European workers, but unfortunately you're not now because of Brexit. Therefore, your workforce doing these jobs that are still going to exist is going to have to come from the UK indigenous population, which means that we're going to have to train them more. We definitely have to give them more support in before they start work than historically we have for Eastern European workers. But you know, they are there and available. So if there's a gradual decline, then we can gradually increase the number of people we put into work from the work programme, or the successors to the work programme. The biggest advantage of all is that up until now, if you've been on benefits, if you take a temporary job, the minute that you start work, your benefits stop. So your personal cash flow suddenly dries up. And because of the way that we and every other employer works, if you start working for us on a Monday, we will pay you for that work the following Friday. So you'll have something like 10 days with no cash coming in. you'll then work for us for a period of time. And at some point, because it's a temporary job, it's likely to come to an end. And at that point, it will take you 2 to 3 weeks to re-establish your claim for benefits, which again means mm-hmm. that you'll have no income during that period of time. So in reality, you'd probably be potty to take a job on that basis, particularly if you have a wife or spouse and children to support.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who's single is probably more likely to be able to survive under that system. Now, that was, as a problem, was recognised by Ian Duncan Smith as when he was DWP Secretary of State, and he introduced universal credit. And the way UC works is very different. You'd never actually sign on or off. The Customs and Excise or the Inland Revenue have introduced something called RTI, real-time information, which means every week that we pay someone, and every employer in the UK has to do the same, the payment that's been made, we have to report into the revenue. They, in turn, report that onto the DWP, who will then adjust the payment to the individual by the amount that that individual's earned, less an amount to give them an incentive, and it's a tapered relief. So somebody who, for instance, has been long-term unemployed and then does 4 hours work for us, just as a taster, just to see how they get on, we'll pay them 4 hours, say at minimum wage, or whatever, they will normally keep about half of that money, and the other half will come off of their benefit payments. So it becomes a real incentive to take work. Now, universal credit is slowly being rolled out. It's not been without its problems, its issues, and it may well take another year or two to be properly, completely rolled out, which so happens to be maybe the time frame for Brexit to be sorted out. So whilst investors don't like change and risk, we see this as a massive opportunity for us to grow again. And it's a question of us managing it well and coming up with good processes to make sure that it all works. But we see this as a good opportunity going forwards, not as a risk. Now, I guess we all have different appetites for investing. And so we're certainly not at the moment completely free of risk in the way that Tesco or one of the FTSE 100 are, but we do have probably bigger opportunity as well. I suppose I can only point to the fact that it's 12 years now since we've been on the market. We have consistently grown. We've consistently had issues and problems that we've had to solve, and have always done so. So whilst I'm not, I don't want to sound cocky or complacent, I'm confident that we will continue to grow going into the future.
Okay. So just going back to the Eastern Europeans briefly then, obviously with, as you say, there doesn't seem to be anybody suggesting that they will actually be sent back under Brexit. But with sterling having devalued a lot recently, obviously one of the attractions of coming to the UK was the higher wages, but that's sort of falling away now, isn't it? And also, I do wonder if in some areas maybe the Eastern Europeans don't feel welcome anymore, because we've had some rather ugly sort of upsurges in racism generally in the country recently. So are those factors, are you starting to see people sort of starting to go back to Eastern Europe overall?
Not so much going back. The second point you make about the racism, you're absolutely correct. And our own directly employed staff have expressed their concern about how they've been treated. And we have had a number of very ugly incidents in some factories, which is quite distressing. Because we're all the same, aren't we? Under the
yes.
If we speak on the day that Trump it's going to become president of the United States.
Mm.
And that may, I don't know, but may end up being incredibly divisive within the US, and Brexit might become so here. And if it does, and the racism continues, then yes, there's a risk that people will go home. I don't think the fall in the pound actually is so important. Yes, the money that they send home buys less, you know, zlotys or whatever, but minimum wage in most of Eastern Europe is just over a pound, or the equivalent of a pound an hour. It's incredibly low. Mm. So you can still earn more by being here. We have seen for a couple of years a diversion where people were coming over here from Eastern Europe. They've been going into Germany and into Austria, where the economies are strong. And it's easier, isn't it? You can drive from Germany to Poland, depending on which part of Germany you're in, you know, in 4 or 5 hours, which is much easier than getting on a Ryanair at Stansted or wherever and going back home. So there has been, over the last couple of years, that movement. And the labour market in the UK has gone much tighter. Again, because of our scale, that's become an advantage to us.
Mm.
You know, we have a database that at the half year, I don't look at the numbers every minute, but at the half year we had 260,000 people on our database looking for work. Talking to the lady who runs our compliance last on Monday, we're currently recruiting 4,500 people a week for work up till Christmas. This time last year we peaked at about 3,000, just under 3,000. So
gosh,
it's, yeah, there are still an awful lot of people looking for work, and yeah, we're becoming, because as we grow we have more work, which means we have more people that will come and work for us, which means we'll get more work, and we're in a kind of virtuous circle at the moment. Last year we grew our recruitment business by 52 on-sites. It was literally one a week across the year, through organic growth, and then through acquisitions we grew another 18. We haven't made any acquisitions this year, but I'm pretty confident that we'll be growing at more or less the same rate this year.
Okay, actually one of my readers has put in a question about that. He's asked, well, he or she, it's not clear, he's asked, your market share in temporary blue-collar workers is around 15%. Can it increase much further, and do you have any targets, presumably acquisition targets?
Right, our market share actually is 8%, and our target is 15%. And that's because it's a relatively low market share. We are already the biggest in the space by a very long way. But the market is so dynamic that I don't know why, I feel that 15% may well be a sort of a natural limit. As we get closer to it, we'll see whether or not it is.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of acquisitions, we made two last year, as I said. They were both, for us, pretty strategic. A business in Northern Ireland called Diamond Recruitment, which has given us a very strong position in that market. We're probably the biggest player now. And then we also bought a business called Milestone in England, which provide HGV drivers to logistics distribution companies and supermarkets. Mm-hmm. Both of those, the Milestone acquisition gave us a footprint across most of England, so it leapfrogged us in terms of market share. Historically, we bought businesses to help us grow, particularly through the recession, and we've changed that policy now. You know, we're not looking to buy a business that doesn't either strategically get us into a new area or into a new customer. So, you know, a customer that we've been trying for years and years to talk to and to supply, if their supplier ends up being for sale, we may choose to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
But we won't be looking to buy simply to grow volumes, because we're growing, you know, at one a week. We're peddling very fast anyway. There's no real need to pay good money to add to that.
No, quite. And actually, the same reader asked a follow-on question saying you're mainly blue-collar temporary workers.
Yeah.
Are there other markets that might be attractive, say white-collar, secretarial, clerical, technical engineering, that type of thing for further expansion?
Yes, there are. So white-collar. The recruitment we do is different to most of the major players in the market. So you know, companies like Adecco and Manpower and Randstad, they run branch networks and they look to place people into permanent roles. We don't do any permanent placements, only temporary. And they're all about matching the right person for the right company in the right job. What we do is manage workforces. So it's not really recruitment. You know, finding the people is recruitment and is very important, but we go a lot further than that. So any area where there's volume recruitment, where the client, the employer, needs lots and lots of people, that where they don't care who the person is, so long as they have the right skill set, is the sort of space we're looking at. So, for example, in white collar, you know, banks, insurance companies, utility companies employ many, many thousands of people in call centres where they don't really care who the person is in the call centre, so long as they're trained and technically able to do the job. Mm. So that's an area that we have moved into. We now have 4 clients in that space. Slow progress, but we're starting with no reputation at all. So that's doing quite well. Other things we're looking at potentially is healthcare, where we're all very ill in our house at the moment.
Yeah. I was going to say you're nursing a heavy cold, aren't you? So I think you're coping very well considering.
And we've got to take the dog to the vet, and I've got a 9-month-old baby that I need to look after while we do that.
Oh, blimey.
She's very unhappy because she's got raging temperature. Do you think, could we carry on later?
Yes, okay, Andy. I think we've covered most of the topics anyway, sir, and we've covered a hell of a lot of ground. So should we leave it there for this time and maybe have another catch-up after the next trading update?
Yeah, of course.
Brilliant.
If in sort of retrospect you think, oh, no, we didn't quite finish off properly, then...
Yes, I'll give you a shout.
And yeah, we'll do.